Consciously Coping with Stress, a talk by Dr. Shanti Rubinstone, MD, presented on Saturday, March 12, 2016, at the Ananda Sangha, Palo Alto, California.
Okay, good. So, I'm just going to, for the sake of this recording, just mention that we're here to talk about consciously coping with stress. It was hard to know where to put the emphasis there. I decided that on the consciously was better than on the stress, but there will be a couple of other people joining us, and many joining us after the fact, vis-a-vis the web. So, has everybody here has taken some meditation, is that right? Great. Then I'd like to start just by spending about 5 minutes in meditation. So for those of you for whom it might have been a while, let's just sit up straight. We know that we want to keep our spine straight so that energy has an easier time flowing, keeping our attention at the point between the eyebrows, because as we'll talk about a lot today, that is where we always want to have as much of our consciousness as possible, really, as the solution to almost every problem in life. And just keeping our palms upward, let's just let's say a little prayer together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Great Saints of Self-Realization, Saints of all religions, we humbly bow before all of you. Divine Mother, Great Masters, be with us this morning. Help us to attune ourselves ever more perfectly to your divine presence within. Help us to find you through intuition, through pure intuitive perception, such that we may know and feel your guidance in everything we do, with everyone we meet. Om, peace, amen. We'll spend about 5 minutes meditating. Om, peace, amen. Okay, great. I may wind up standing up. Let's see, just see how I'm comfortable. So, good morning, everybody. I realized last night, because the title of this talk is so simple in a way. As I was thinking about it yesterday and thinking about where would I like to go with it, I was asking myself, what new slant could I put on this? And I said to myself after sitting, I was literally meditating for about 30 minutes, I asked Master, I asked Swamiji, and then I said to myself, there really is no new slant here. And it's interesting how much for those of you who have been coming to Sunday service, you heard me say this last week or the week before, I don't remember, but in the subjects of Sunday service these last 3 weeks and tomorrow, they're exactly the same subject. Swamiji words them a little differently. He takes a different quote from the Bible, but the topic of all of those sermons is basically, what does it mean to try and know God intellectually versus really doing whatever it is we need to do in life to be able to have that intuitive perception of the truth? Can you all hear me? Yeah, I'm going to turn this off for right now. And so for 4 weeks, it's just been a dance of figuring out, hearing the inspiration for what to say about the same exact topic, sort of week after week. But clearly the fact that he's given it 4 weeks out of our whole year, and close to the beginning of the year, because you all know these subjects repeat themselves, it just says to me, this is the essence of all it is. This is so meaningful and important. We're all getting week after week after week an opportunity to feel the inspiration about this, that very topic, which is, you can learn as much as you want to know, you can study as much, you can try and figure it out, but you're never going to know God that way, which is really the essence of Shankya philosophy. Of course, God cannot be known, meaning God can only be perceived, remembered, realized. And as I've been listening to some of Swamiji's talks over this last month or two, a lot of them, I came across something in two talks that really surprised me, not because I hadn't thought it myself, but because he said it so clearly. And he said, we never really learn anything new on the spiritual path. And he was giving a lecture. You know, there's a whole series of Swamiji's lectures that have been made public. They've been digitized and put out there called Treasures Along the Path. They really are treasures. They're all of his talks from the 1970s on that have been made available to us. And literally now you can just buy one flash drive and they're all there. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of talks. And every month, Krishna, who runs that program up at the village, adds a new talk. And she actually does an online satsang around it. But the point is that all of that wisdom is so easily available. And during one of his talks, he says, you're sitting here and you, meaning whoever was in the audience at the time, have been listening to me for years now, but I don't think I've ever told you anything that you don't already know. And then he said, which was really interesting to me, he said, I don't think Master ever told us anything we didn't know. He said, what we do is we hold it in a way, we frame it in a way, we give you new ideas such that it can be revealed to you again. We can enliven an idea. We can help you remember, not just in our minds, of course, but remember with our being, that wonderful Sanskrit word, smriti, that has no English equivalent, really. But he said that. He said, Master's never taught any of us anything. Literally, I went back to listen to it to make sure, if you're going to quote that, you want to make sure it's accurate. But he did. And I knew how often that has been true for me. I would be sitting and listening to Swamiji or many other people who speak, not even just on our path, but because for the last 30 years it's been on this path, it's mostly who I listen to. And I thought, I know that. Why didn't I ever think to say that? You know, it doesn't sound new to me, but I would have never held it like that. I would have never thought to put it in words like that. And, you know, it just, I'm saying this right now because, particularly right now, I guess for two reasons. Number one is, as I think all of you know, Ash has been away for a couple of weeks because a dear friend of ours, Tushti, is passing. We all thought it would happen a couple of weeks ago. And I, for one, and many, encouraged Asha to go and be there. It felt like her place to help Tushti pass. And now it's been 2 weeks. And it doesn't sound like a long time. And it's perfect, the way everything is perfect. But everybody's been impacted, I think mostly in very positive ways. And this that I'm about to say is also positive, but I took on Asha's life and my life so that Asha's classes, the events, her Sunday services, you know, I've just wound up doing. So I've been speaking, I think, more than I usually speak. This particular talk today, which was mine from the beginning, I realize when you want to talk about consciously coping with stress, really, that's the whole spiritual path. That's by definition what the path is, because everything in life is stressful to us. Everything. And it's not as if it's not meant to be. Life is not meant to be easy. Therefore, the whole Bhagavad Gita takes place on a battlefield, you know, which in essence says to us, this is what life is. This is how Krishna was going to tell Arjuna everything he needed to learn, which was how to do battle. And he was not going to, excuse me for a moment, I guess I'll just, sorry, I heard that, Chandra will get it, let him off of any hooks. Arjuna really fought hard, as we all know, saying, I don't want to do this. He gave Krishna a lot of reasons why it was not a good battle to fight. It was certainly not his to fight. This had nothing to do with the kind of person he was. Furthermore, these were his cousins, and how could he kill his cousins? And he just went on and on. And I think most of us have heard that story many times. But, hi, Angelina, welcome, honey. Yeah. Can you hear the Bhagavad Gita too much? I mean, it's the essence of everything we need to learn. And it's important to know now when we're talking about stress, that is what life is. And it doesn't get easier. You know, I think as I look around at everybody in this room, maybe all but a couple of you, though I'm not sure this has exclusively to do with age, but there are many moments in life, in this one life, where you actually believe, really believe, that after you get through with something, life's going to get easier. And you think that's true, and it looks like it's going to be true. So when you're in college, and particularly if you're in college and you're working, you think, as soon as I don't have to study so much, life will get easier. And then you get married, and you actually think it's going to be 1 + 1 and make it easier. And then you have children, and that gets really hard, and you're certain as soon as the kids get older, life's going to get easier. And then you get to be my age, and you realize that was never true, and you can see that it's never going to be true for anybody. It's not the nature of life to get easier or less stressful. In fact, for those of us who are living the way we're living, it's exactly the opposite. That if we can figure out what to do with each of those hurdles, each of those challenges as they come to us, that is the very purpose of life. If somebody were to take away all of the, what we're calling stress, but it's really all of that that comes to us that requires us to come to life with a lot of energy. If somebody were to take it all away, and if we could just go to sleep and relax, then, and I can say this in this room, we would just be living the way the vast majority of people in the world live, which is to say, unconsciously, not consciously. It's not really what we want, though in any given moment we might think that. The other day I left the church. It wasn't last night, so it was Thursday night. And I went to drive to my house, which is in Menlo Park on Alpine Road. I actually have two homes, so I live in the community, but I was going to my other house that night. On a bad day, it's 11 minutes from here. And so I called my husband, and I said, I'm on my way home. He always comes out and greets me and carries things in for me. But I also said, could you take this out of the refrigerator? And I'll see you, you know, it's raining, so maybe it'll be 15 minutes. And I got home 1 hour and 10 minutes later. And by that time, I had been so agitated trying to get down Foothill, then I had cut over campus, then campus was a mess, then I went all the way into Palo Alto, made a U-turn, came back, went up El Camino. I mean, and I said to myself, when are you going to get it, Shanti? Nothing's moving anywhere. You are meant to be in this car. And when I got in, you know, my husband, who knew I had been in the car now for 1 hour and 15 minutes, and he greets me, hi, honey, how are you? And I wanted to say to him, I have to admit, I was not completely on top of this, how could you be asking me that question? You know what's been going on in my life. But I said to him, can you give me 5 minutes, you know, just like that. He said, sure, do you need any help? I said, no, I need no help. Can you just give me 5 minutes alone? And then I said to myself, it was a traffic jam, Shanti, that's all. It was an opportunity to be quiet in the car, get over it. You know, this kind of, not exactly wisdom, but realizing you could spend the night being agitated about that, which quite frankly, a lot of people do. It's not that uncommon for people to get really irritable about just that level of stuff. And then I say to people, so I said to myself, whether it's 2 hours or tomorrow with this little thing, this is going to be so not in your mind, you'll have no memory of it. It won't matter one bit. Let it go now. And fortunately, I could. It's easy to imagine that because everybody could sit and say, of course, why would you get so upset about a traffic jam? But those things grab us. Unless we're being conscious, consciously choosing to bring a different kind of energy. And we get a lot of practice in this life with little things like that. So that we practice and we practice. And then when the really big stuff comes, like Tushti leaving her body, 68-year-old woman, it's not that she's so young, but she felt young to all of us. Tushti epitomized for many of us being in great shape, having great energy. She was a manifestation of love, steadfastness, centeredness. Anybody in the room who knows her would be shaking their head yes. And if you didn't, just take my word for it. I don't think I ever heard anybody say anything but that they loved that woman and how much she meant in their lives. And that's quite something. You know, that is really quite something. I can say that I've loved a lot, given a lot, but boy, could I start listing the people who find me to be unimaginably irritating and don't want to be near me. You know, most of us have bigger personalities that are out there, or at least many of us do. But she was extraordinary. But as I listened to her, because Asha's right there and writing these beautiful letters, I realized that all of the way that Tushti is leaving, which is so beautiful and so much like a Kriya Yogi, without ever missing a beat, she's leaving her body, this world, all of life as she remembers it right now. Her husband, who she's been so close with, all of her friends, all of the things that she was sure she had to finish in this life. And doing it with such grace and ease and, I don't know, for lack of a better word or words, spiritual poise. I don't know how else to say it, but it's so beautiful. And you just realize that's what happens when you're a yogi and you practice and you practice. And, you know, you get to practice in tiny little ways and then in traffic jams that are a little irritating. And then the ways get bigger and bigger. And then when you get really good, you realize you get home and you didn't even need 5 minutes. You were just perfectly okay through the whole thing, whatever the whole thing was. So we come to realize that not only is stress the nature of the human condition, but essential and necessary part of the human condition. It is precisely why we're here. And then we start looking at, okay, how are we going to do this consciously? I'd just like to say a little bit more about stress in our world. Then I would like to hear from as many people who want to tell me what drew you here today, because we're small. This can go a lot of ways. Make sure that all of your questions get addressed if that can happen here. I looked up last night just out of interest to try and find some data about stress in the world, because I think you all know that I'm a physician. I think you all know. If you don't, you know now. And for many, many years, I had the third largest medical practice in the United States, which is quite something. I mean, it was big, is what it was. That's the something. All by way of saying, all of these years, I've met a lot of people. And I've met them in that position of they're coming to see a doctor. At least until they learned who I was, they were coming just like everybody comes, with whatever would have you want to see your doctor. A cough, a cold, a headache, back pain, whatever. And one very quickly becomes aware of the fact that there's a huge percentage of what brings people to a doctor that is what I would call stress-related. And then you start looking at the data, and the data says 80% of doctor's visits probably have at their origin stress. And maybe the people aren't sleeping, which is one of the biggest reasons people come. Headaches are a big reason. Back pain is a big reason. Abdominal pain. I mean, I can go through most of the time what fills up most of a doctor's day are these things, but always people have been able to trace them back to stress-related illnesses. And if the doctor happens to be willing to ask even one or two questions, something as simple as, is there anything going on in your life right now that you think might be causing this new symptom, whatever it is, or an old symptom? Very often people tell the truth. It's amazing. I mean, to their doctor. It's just that most doctors never ask that question. You know, I would say most of you would raise your hands if I said to you, has any doctor ever said to you, tell me about your life in any greater detail than specifically about the problem? Very few physicians do that. But if you ask questions, it's amazing how often people will tell the truth. And then I pulled out all of this data. I have it here, but I'm not going to bore you with it. About studies that are done every year by the American Psychological Association, which I knew nothing about, but I was just Googling it last night, looking around, about stress in America, whether and how people view their lives. Do they have more stress than they did last year or less? Are they better at coping with it than they were? What are the techniques they're using? Who do they hold responsible? And it's really fascinating to just have it all there right in front of you about how most people move through life. And I want to say, I'll say this about myself, but I think it's true in some ways for all of us. If it were not true, we just wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be in these bodies. We wouldn't be working through life the way we are. That even though we are making great effort to move through life with awareness and to be able to concentrate on things and to be able to raise our energy and use energy and transform it and just be conscious and aware in these ways, we remain unconscious much of the time. We just do. It's a hard thing to get because you don't get it until maybe even somebody else helps you see it, or an hour later you say to yourself, wait a minute, what was I doing? Or you wind up in a fight with your partner, and then as you calm down, you maybe realize what you brought to it. All the ways that it can come to our mental attention. But until then, we live unconsciously a lot. I was just asking myself on the way up here, just driving in this little drive from the community up here this morning, how often do I really hold the knowing that God is the doer? It's so essential on a path to remember that we're not doing anything, that God is working through us, to not take credit or blame or any of that for anything. And it came to mind for me right now because of what's being offered to me, because of the opportunities that I've had in these last weeks to really step up to a plate. And the plate is really willingness. That's what the plate is. Am I willing to serve as a channel? Not gee, how great of a talk can I give at Sunday service tomorrow? What idea can I come up with at Master's Mahasamadhi? What kind of a program can I pull together for our church? That's the me. That's when I actually think I'm responsible for everything, and it gets very quickly exhausting and overwhelming, which is what most of the people feel about their lives. You hear how often the word overwhelmed comes up. It's incredible. Fatigue. They feel enormous fatigue. One of the number one things, what do people do when they start feeling really stressed and overwhelmed? People go to bed. They want to go to sleep. It's the first thing people want to do. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't sleep when we're tired, but we should sleep when we're tired, just like we should eat when we're hungry. It should be conscious. But we're not driven to climb into bed all the time and keep the covers up over our head. Hopefully, we're not. If we are, it's just something to look at. Because as I said just a minute ago, even those of us who are here, and I don't know, does anybody know the origin of the phrase preaching to the choir? I have to look that up sometime because it comes to mind a lot. I don't particularly love those words, but I like the meaning behind it. Obviously, I'm speaking to a group of people today who came here with the word consciously in the title of a talk. So that says a lot. And I'm aware of that. But I could still say we move unconsciously a lot. And again, I don't want to be too presumptuous about any of your lives, but there's at least some chance that it's as true about everyone as it is about me and everyone and Ananda. I mean, we're trying really hard. But again, I just have that little question with myself. How often do you realize, Shanti, that God is the doer? And I just said to myself, you have a long way to go. I could always remind myself before every one of these talks, and I do, Master, you better show up and give this talk through me. I'm just waiting for you. You know, and when I turn around on a Sunday morning and look at those masters before I speak, I've never been more serious about telling them, you speak through me, ever. You know, one time, I don't know, it was about a year ago or so, I was giving a Sunday service. And I've said this many times, so some of you know, of all of the Ananda places to give a Sunday service, this church is a little more, I don't know what the word is, really. It's compelling. It gets your attention because it's huge. Very easy to sit here. I could talk with you guys for 8 hours or at you. I'd have something to say, no problem, any topic. I go down to Scotts Valley and give a service. Maybe there were, I don't know if there were 50 people in the room or 40. Easy, nothing, never thought anything about it. When I stand up here, I think about it. It's just different. I often want to say to everybody, I want to step off of the dais, get down there and say to everybody, pull your chairs up. You know, it would just feel so much more like this to me and more and easier in a way. But it always gives me pause. And when I was telling you, one day I was in the middle of giving a Sunday service and I just suddenly not only forgot where I was, not literally physically where I was, but where I was in my mind with the talk, I had no idea of what to say next. I mean, zero. I couldn't think of one thing to say, and it was just about 8 minutes into the sermon. And I'm sitting there, and I'm up there, stopped, and I'm saying, oh, this is cute, you know, and I start yelling at the masters behind me, where are you guys? What's going on here, I'm saying. And then I turned around, literally in the middle of a sermon, and I said to them, quietly, not into my microphone, if you want these people to hear any more words, you better speak them. My mind was totally blank. And I turned around, and of course, they did. Thank goodness. Thank God, I could say, really. It was a very interesting experience. So, yes, in those moments, one becomes totally clear that we're just a channel and that they're using us. But often that's not where I am. Often I actually believe it's me. And you just realize how challenging life is to live it perfectly in tune with the path, and how many opportunities we're being given, which we call, if we wanted to lump it all together, we can call it stress, or the challenges become stressful. So before I go on, if anybody wants to say, I'm interested in what drew people here today, why you came, I mean, it could be a general answer, it could be about the topic, but just why are you here? What would you like to leave with? A big challenge, I think, and I'll speak to it in a minute or over the next minutes. But yeah, it is very stressful. I mean, I can absolutely relate to it, but I know everybody can. Even Jan, she's adorable. I mean, she forgive me if I speak about you for a while, but I said this to Jan a couple years ago in the middle of a big women's retreat she was having, that I wanted everybody else in the room to know how seriously she takes her path, because she wasn't saying it for herself, but those of us here have watched her, and she really serves beautifully and shows up and puts in enormous effort, and we all know that. Appreciate it just for the spirit of it, because we learn from it, but we also appreciate it because she does a lot around here. But she walked in this morning, and she goes, oh, I didn't know if I was going to make it on time. And then she starts saying whatever it was. I don't know. I forget all of what happened. But workmen were showing up, and this happened, and she has to get everybody organized. And it's complicated. Life is complicated. And at every moment, it will conspire against us. You know, there's a book, I hope I can remember this quote, let me see, called Callings, that I've spoken to a couple of you about. I love this book, though I haven't looked at it for a while now. I used to open it up, it and another book called The Miracle of Change. Those were two books that for decades I never gave a talk. I mean, in big public venues where I used to speak, where I wouldn't open those books and read something from them, because they are just filled with wisdom and inspiration, both of them. But the author of Callings, his name is Greg Lavoie, a wonderful man, very just filled with, he must have been taking notes about quotes and sayings and, you know, for his whole life, because that book is filled with so many of these, and this person said that and this one said that, but they're all good. You want to read it all. But he said, the minute you decide to do something wonderful for yourself, every devil in hell will step up to greet you. And it's just so perfect. It's exactly what happens. And we think it's what's keeping us, as I was saying before, from what we're meant to do. As soon as we turn our minds around and get that what we're meant to do is deal with the devils. Because interestingly, and there's no way to do it but to deal head on with them. It's virtually impossible. You can't work around it, and you can't sort of get too logical about it, because let's face it, we could spend the rest of this life making schedules, making tables, making lists, planning things, really. And I'm a Virgo, very organized, huge list maker. I love lists. And everything's in a different color. And people who know me well often give me huge boxes of colored pencils for gifts. I mean it. And this, my calendars, yeah, even my electronic calendars now, they're all filled with color. So I'm not opposed to them. But I have moved one to-do item onto a new list, sometimes for a year and a half or 2 years. You know, you just, and then all of a sudden one day I'll look at it and I'll say, oh, it's irrelevant now. And I get to throw it off the list, but it never got done. This is not anything that we can approach logically. We have to see it as, I don't know if you were here when I was talking about the battlefield of Kurukshetra, Angelina, if you walked in after that, but I just want to say it back at you right this moment, that the entire Bhagavad Gita takes place on a battlefield for a reason, because there was no other place that Krishna, God, was going to be able to tell Arjuna, disciple every man, right? He represents all of us, how to make it through life to knowing God, remembering who he really is, other than moving through these battles. So one thing is, with great energy, great courage, great power and stamina, to see these things that challenge us as our friends. Because otherwise, if we're constantly looking at them as an enemy, and that mindset, it is taking our energy in the wrong direction. You know, this is a very interesting thing about life. You cannot solve problems of the ego with the ego. It's impossible, because it is the ego's nature. It's absolutely its nature to keep us bound to delusion, to keep us wrapped up. I mean, I applaud your courage for saying out loud, and I take it very seriously what your stress is, but that's your stress. And if we get too logical about it, it'll never let you out of it. And again, I'm going to come back and I will say more, but because the ego is just doing what it's meant to do very well. The ego, right, as the soul identified with this body, it is the essence of duality, work, spirit, positive, negative, right, wrong, good, bad. That's its whole purpose in life. As soon as we get done with that, it has no reason to be in this body. We go back to being one with spirit and with soul. We leave it. But as long as we're in this body, there will be that tug of war. There has to be. And so we have to find a way beyond ego, because we can't solve a lot of these problems with our mind. And we get into a battle. And there's a wonderful story, but I want to think if I can remember it. I'm sorry. I can't use it right now because I can't get the punchline right. So my mind doesn't want to go there. But really, the truth is it's a story that just beautifully illustrates the fact that we can't use a weapon to fight a disease that has the disease itself in it, because it can't get on top of it or really larger than it. But let me come back to that in a minute, Rohit.
My question is, my name is Rohini, and I teach second grade. I have a lot of stress 6 hours of my day, and that spills over in my body and all that. Consciously dealing with stress, do you plan, like, I know tomorrow the kids are going to be back and blah, blah, blah. I plan to approach it consciously before, or do I analyze it after, or do I do both? And then in the moment, what happens?
So what I want to say is, in the moment doesn't work, because we have to be prepared. This is why I bothered to tell this story about Tushti, who's dying so beautifully. And one of the things that Asha wrote that's incredibly apparent is, many of us have watched a lot of people die Watching a Kriya yogi die, whole new experience. And why is that? Not because death is easier for her than for anybody, but because for decades she has been getting up and living her life as a practice for that moment. So if we wait till we're in it, you know, if we wait till we're in a fight with our spouse to try and figure it out, how often has that worked for anybody in this room, really? Never. The answer is never. But if you work things out ahead of time, and if you go into that relationship centered in calmness within yourself, no matter what happens out there, you're much more prepared for battle. You know, I was a hospitalist for many years. It means I went into the hospital to see all of the patients for our big 45 physician practice. I made rounds on all of the people that were in the hospital. That's a lot of what I did with a certain period of my life. And there were many times where I would choose to lock myself in a linen closet or in a supply closet for a few minutes and do a few rounds of Hong Sa. Mm-hmm. Now, and it worked, you know. And people would say to me, "Does anything ever bother you, Dr. Rubenstone?" And I'm thinking to myself, "Everything?" But I didn't say that out loud. But I'm thinking, really, they're asking me that? That was their perception of me. And my perception of me was, where's the nearest linen closet? You know, I have to come back to center. But I would never have known to do that. The only difference between me and the rest of, or many of the physicians they were dealing with, who just scream at people to get things done, which really actually happens, is that I had learned to do Hong Sa, you know, years ago, decades ago, with Swamiji. And the more we practice it, the more it's right there, and we can do it even when, and I know you can't hide in a closet when you're dealing with second graders, but I mean, I know that. You know, this is really the... This is the truth, is that for years and years, not only did I take care of a lot of teachers, but now, as you know, we have this school. And for so long, I've thought to myself, this is really interesting. For much of my professional career, I was working a minimum of 14, often 16 hours a day. I don't get off at Easter. I didn't get off at Christmas. I do not have a summer break. I mean, I'd say this to myself. The patients don't go home at 3:30 in the afternoon. Why are they so much more stressed than I am? You know, and every once in a while I still say, sort of, what's the difference? Because really, life doesn't stop. It's when, you know, you don't have those built-in breaks as a very busy physician, minister, lawyer, I mean, whatever it is you're doing. But I've come to realize that never being able to even go to the bathroom when you need to, I mean, there's so many more things that teachers deal with. Clearly, it's true for almost every teacher, almost, that I know. So there's something about that job that just takes most people right to the edge. So I can appreciate when I say to you, I know you can't hide in a closet. For those 6 hours a day, you can't hide if you have second graders back to back. But I do think that we have to, you know, this is what being on a spiritual path means. It's why we call it a spiritual practice, is because then in those moments, literally we have learned already how to transform energy. And that's what it's about. And if we're not practicing, which means really in the end, it always comes down to meditation. It just simply does. Who was it who was just telling me? We were in a meeting with Ramurti and Sita, who live in our community, but who just spent 9 weeks in India. And one of their experiences in India is that they met some teacher, I don't remember his name, he was not on our path, and I don't even remember why they went there. Maybe maybe he was a disciple of one of these masters, so they are on our path, but I don't remember. But somehow the whole group, once they were on pilgrimage, went there, and Sita said they spent hours with him. And people would ask him these long, complicated questions, and at the end of everything, he would sit and, you know, really be with it, like you'd expect him to come up with all these sayings from the Gita and from the Vedas or something. That's what everybody was waiting for. And then he'd say to everybody, keep meditating. She said he said it to every person. He would sit with the question for, you know, and I often think to myself, I just must sound like a broken record. I mean, I said at Sunday service last week or sometime recently, when I went to Scotts Valley to give service 2 weeks ago, and I was telling you it's smaller, and the topic was dogmatism versus common sense. And I was sitting there waiting. You know, we do all this other stuff in Sunday service. And I said to myself, do you have the courage? If you had enough courage, you could just stand up and say to everybody, meditate more, and let's meditate together right now. And just sit down. And for the 25 minutes that I was going to give the sermon, we could just meditate together, because that really is the answer to everything. Now, it's not what they wanted to hear in the moment, and it turned out it was a delightful day, and in that moment it was fun giving the sermon, and everybody enjoyed it, but I don't know if I did them a favor or not, you know, because the answer to what you're asking is not in the moment, but it is without a doubt a guarantee that if we, and this is your issue, and I know that, if we can get to that point where we have a regular spiritual practice that involves some form of being quiet and going within and finding ourselves in our astral spine, no matter what we are faced with, no matter what, difficult spouses, kids in trouble, second graders 5 days a week for 9 months of the year, a diagnosis of cancer in us or our children. I mean, all the things that can happen in life, and there are an endless number of things, and they will happen. They will. We will be absolutely more prepared to deal with them. You know, of all strange things, every once in a while, because I don't really like to watch television very much, but it comes up in my home every once in a while that it would be a nice thing to do. So my husband usually saves these programs for me, like, you know, a lot of travel programs and animal programs, and you know what they are. They're beautiful, and they're wonderful, and they're fine to watch. But one of the things that we watch together every once in a while, I'm embarrassed to say it, but is the Weather Channel does these specials, and they're extraordinary sometimes. But last week, I was watching one, and it was about some, let me just come back to my center here. Okay. You know, our cell phones all go off with these noises, and the noises all mean something to each of us. Oh. So it's like behavior modification. Even if I hear a certain thing in my mind, it means text or email or whatever. It's so distracting. It's very hard to let go of it, because it's not what it means to everybody else, but it's what it means to me. But anyway, it was one of them was on the tsunami that was in Japan, and there was a videographer who, for whatever reason, I mean, he ran right up on top of a fire escape, and he filmed the entire thing as it was happening. And there was somebody there next to him, a friend. He had said to this friend, we need to go higher, we need to go higher, and they kept going higher. And he was filming it. But his friend said to him, if I didn't know Buddha, or he said it in some very Japanese way, I am Buddha, or I would be dead. Mm-hmm. And then he said, and more frightened. Now they were watching, It was horrific. I finally had to say, I can't watch this. You know, like these 18-wheelers just look like little toys. And I mean, everything that happened, it was, I'm sure all of us saw some of it, but he filmed the whole thing. It was really quite something. But right in that moment, in the middle of that, that took, what, 15,000 lives or something? I mean, it was one of the biggest disasters in the history of the world as we could report it right now or know it. I'm sure not in the history of everything, but as we could report it. Huge. But he was saying, I am Buddha. This man was saying. And many people were just screaming, screaming, screaming. But he remembered who he was. That comes from practice. You know, that is, there is no other way. And this is a really hard thing to say, because I'm not saying it insensitively at all. But part of why I always share with people, not always, but when I do, that I'm a doctor, that I have the third largest practice, that I am now the manager of this church, that means not just all of the ground stuff and the light bulbs and the air conditioning and the when we need new carpet and all of that, but it means the whole congregation. It means all of the people who I want to see and reach out to. And I'm a minister, and I give a lot of classes and talks, and I practice medicine still many hours a week. It's a big life. It is a very big life. Now, this is how Master's chosen to use me, and I know that. There are simply people who are being used in other ways, and they could not live this life. I don't take credit for it. In fact, from a human perspective, I would say, what is wrong with me that I'm doing all of this? And many people try and tell me, much of the time, you're doing too much. What does that mean? That means in their mind, for them, I'm doing too much. But they have no idea what my karma is or what it feels like to me. But when it gets to the point where we're feeling ourselves it's too much, then only we can make that change. And what that change is, I don't know. You know, we each have to think it through. I've cut back and back and back on the medicine that I'm doing. I closed my whole private practice. I see just people in consultation, certain number of hours a week. You know, but I've rearranged life because, mostly because Master told me to, is the bottom line. But how did he tell me to? Because 16 years ago, it came to me. I was already meditating. I was already on this path. I wrote things 30 years ago. I read them now. I could have written them yesterday. But 16 years ago, when I was living a very, very big life out there and meditating when I had time and going to Sunday service if and when I had time, I heard it is time to change the foreground and background of your life. You have to turn your life around. You have to put God and meditation and serving and all the things it was time for me to do. I'm not preaching this because everybody's path is completely unique. And I don't live in judgment around this. But at some point, for me to be able to do what I'd been thinking for years, I want to, I want to, I want to, I can't, I can't, I can't. It should have been, I want to, I want to, I want to, but I'm not ready and I won't. And when it was time, then I said to the people who I was working with, I'm giving you 6 months' notice and I'm leaving. And they all thought my life was so perfect, and this is true. I'm sharing it not about me, but about all of us. They wanted me to see a psychiatrist. They thought I needed help, because why would anybody walk out on this utterly perfect life? And I said to them, no. In fact, that would be the last thing I need to do. I am moving more towards healing and peace than you can know. And it was true. My colleagues and all of the other people who were around me in medicine could have no idea. But I knew. And when any of us know, and I'm saying it out loud, obviously, Angelina, because you asked this question, it's not that it was easy. Everybody said, oh, how great that you could do that. because it was in my life, it looked easy. But I was walking away from being a very well-paid, busy, highly sought-after picture all over billboards, all over Baltimore. This is the woman you want to see. I mean, if anybody was waiting to have their ego fed, it was there. It was happening. And it was not totally easy to walk away from that. But I was determined. I needed to do it. And I prayed about that. I took a 3-week seclusion, and I prayed harder than I've ever prayed about anything until that time. And then I came back, and I said to everybody, I'm leaving. It really came to me. That book, Callings, that I told you about, it had been given to me 3 times in the year before. I had 3 copies of it on my bookshelf. And during that seclusion, I read it. And I realized that making these changes is never easy. It is not easy, you know? And I just want to say again, this is what Krishna said to Arjuna. Yes, they're your cousin brothers, but you need to kill them. And you can't do this path with 1 foot here and 1 foot here because the boats start separating and you fall in the water. And when you really get serious about it, we do what we need to do. And that's just only when it's supposed to happen. But we make changes. And I look at least several of you, and I already know of changes that you've made, and I know what's happening. And I'm not, there's no guilt attached to this. There's just the honest realization that it takes enormous effort. You know, very often in the world, people think that getting calm or dealing with our stress means being apathetic or bringing less energy. I grew up in the 60s, that's a lot of what it looked like. Hey, we're calm, we're cool. Hey, we'll just have another hit of dope here and everything's beautiful. And everything was beautiful. And I did my fair share of that. But fortunately, I didn't think that means we go to sleep. We don't die to it. We don't just, forgive me for saying this, but look like a lot of what Santa Cruz looks like. You know, you can see a lot of people walking around Santa Cruz who grew up when I did, who've still been smoking a little bit of marijuana every day. They're like, hey, everything's cool. Not the way I want my life to be cool. It's not my karma. My karma was to say yes. This was absolutely right the way I grew up. I grew up when people were saying, make love, not war. What's bad about that? I grew up when every singer that I loved, all of the folk songs, most of what the Beatles talked about, it wasn't bad music. It was about peace and harmony. It was about caring about other people. It may not have been Swami's music, but it was beautiful music. It wasn't acid rock. It wasn't heavy metal. You know, it wasn't. It was beautiful. But, you know, it's very interesting. Master has this, made this comment to, I think it was Swami, but it was at least in front of the monks, and Swami was there, when somebody was asking this question about, what about all the people who are very well-intentioned, people who do a lot of good things in the world? And there are many people who do good things in the world. They're out there for all the right political causes and social causes, and you know, they're really helping people change and do good things. But very much to Swami's surprise, Master looked at him and said, the road to Hades is paved with good intentions. It was an interesting response. I mean, Master was not going to let go of that teaching that, and I'm going to finish that thought, but in our Sunday service in the festival, every week we say, and Jesus appeared to Babaji and said, the lights on my lower altars are still filled with good works, but the noble taper of inner communion with thee burns low and is ill attended. Those are amazing words. That means people are doing some good things right now. This is Jesus going to Babaji. This is how Master came here. Let us together, united in Christ love, not even Christ's, no, not possessive, united in Christ's love, set lights ablaze on that higher altar once again, and then the masters from this path were sent to earth. It's so beautiful when you hear it and when you really let it in. It says, do what you need to do in this life, but even if you're doing good things, it's really not the same as seeking God. It's not. We can fight against that. We can scream and yell about it. We can throw temper tantrums. We can deny it. We can have a million incarnations go by, or 10 million, right? Or we can do what most of us do, decide we're going to do something, and then you wake up and it's next year. And then you decide again, and then it's next year. And I was recently at a friend's home. I've known them for a very long time. I love these people. They're like a brother and a sister. They have a son who they adopted at age 3, who's been a drug addict and seriously psychiatrically ill. I mean, all of his life, and he's now probably close to 40. Long and complicated story. They're in their middle 70s, and they've raised his now 12-year-old son, but they've had him for 12 years because their adopted son was incapable of doing it. And I'm trying to remember why I started this story. Let me see if I can remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Basically, we've had this talk a lot, the three of us, me and them. And I said to them, I don't have a lot more words for you, but here's what I'm going to say to you. You keep thinking if you divorce yourself from your son that you're leaving him to die, and maybe you are. Maybe he needs to die. But how about if we look at it and say, look at all the love and joy you have brought him in this incarnation. And if it's his time to leave right now, look at how you've helped him spiritually and let him go. Let him go. Because guess what? We've been having this talk, the three of us, for almost 30 years. And you two are 75 years old. When are you going to do this? Or you'll die with it. 30 years we've been having this talk. What's the best way to help him? I have no more words, except it was an inspiration to say, boy, have you helped him spiritually, which they have. And maybe you'd be giving him a gift if you let him out of his body right now. Let him go overdose or die on the streets. I mean, you all know me. I'm not this cold, heartless. But maybe this is it for the incarnation. And guess what? You get to do some other kind of work for the next, how long do you have? One, I said to them, 1 year, 5 years. I wanted to say to them, a minute? Guess what? You're 75. You know, you have a lot more life behind you than you do in front of you. A lot. I mean, I could say that to the 12-year-old son. Don't waste a minute of this precious incarnation. Don't waste a minute. But it's hard to say it to a 12-year-old. A little easier to 75-year-olds, but they weren't listening any better than he would have, and the 40-year-old is in la-la land. So, but this is what happens. If we don't say, this is the moment, and to everybody around us, guess what, everybody? I'm changing right now. That is really hard for people. But if we don't do it, when are we going to do it? Just year after year after year, life goes by. We have the same conversations. We're stressed by the same things unless we work really hard right now. And for some people, the next step might be doing a good thing in the world, might be working for a socially conscious organization. I mean, that's why I want everybody to hear this isn't critical of that. It's just saying, we're here because we came to a talk that said consciously coping with stress. And consciously, in our language, means super consciously. That is what it means. And it means understanding this is not a simple thing that I'm saying. that we have to bring energy to things, that having no energy is not how it works, that turning our back on it, whatever the it is, that a big part of the spiritual path is really doing whatever we need to do that's going to help us draw our energy up. And here's something else I want to say. And I've been totally focused on this. I just did this 3-week seclusion, and in it I spent a lot of time studying Patanjali. And it becomes crystal clear with Patanjali's teachings, because when you read those sutras, there is no fat. It is just the simple truth. You either get it or you don't. He just says it like it is. I wish I brought the book in, and I will after a break. This is, you know, you read the third sutra or the 12th. Well, you want to study it for the whole rest of your life, one sutra. I said sometime recently in some talk, Sri Yukteswar used to sit for weeks with any one sutra, sometimes months, with Master. And Master would start getting bored, and Sri Yukteswar would say to him, no, you don't know this sutra yet. You don't know what you need to learn from it. Until some point, long before they had finished all of the sutras, he said, we don't need to study them anymore. Because Matt, and this is why, this is subtle, but it's the point I wanted to share. If we think that we're going to go after this problem, and this problem, and this problem, and this problem, that's a trillion lives. That's why Master had to write his poem, The Boatman. And I will come again and again, crossing crags of whatever, I'm sorry, I can't quote it, with bleeding feet, a trillion times if I need to, if even one soul is waiting for me. And at Master's Mahasamadhi, in my talk, I said, let's not be the reason he needs to come a trillion times. We love him. We don't want to do that to him. I meant it. I mean, people giggled, but I wasn't joking. Let's get to this now. But that's how long it takes. If we try and solve the problems down here, we cannot do that. And what Sri Yukteswar was saying to Master, and what I could say in more simple terms, is if we, just because what Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all else shall be added unto you. You know, studying Patanjali, it gives even that new meaning. You can't solve the problem at the problem's level. There are too many of them. Every devil in hell steps up to greet you. You have got to do everything you can do every moment to raise your energy up, because the problems keep going. They do not change. It's us. We need to step into the light. And that takes energy. It's raising energy. The natural way for things to go, the easier way in this human condition, is down. Gravity, everything's pulling us down. And even us, it just gets subtle. It's as subtle as, wow, I love this program that I wrote for the Mahasamadhi. Serious mistake. Instead of, Master, I am so grateful that you brought this program through, and knowing it and believing it, you know? And I'm saying it to you because I love the program that I wrote. I actually have said that to myself several times, corrected myself, and I still keep saying it. And that just takes me 100% in the wrong direction. And it's meaningful. It's hard. It's so easy to go there, to just get enamored with all of the things, with how well we do anything. Practicing medicine is so much easier for me. It would be way easier for me to have a very busy practice than to do what I'm doing in life. Because I go to practice medicine. There's a lot of inspiration behind it. Everybody loves me. I get a lot of kudos there. And because I've practiced as much as I've practiced, I come up with a lot of great diagnoses that other doctors have missed. It happens all the time. All the time. I'm sharing these stories with you because they're what goes on in the real world, but I'm trying to shed light on them. I'll just share something with you, and then we'll take a break. One of the ways I practice medicine right now is I do urgent care at Kaiser. Just about 6 shifts a month, that's what I do, to keep this medicine in my head and also to support myself. It's part of how I pay the rent. But yesterday this woman came in. She had been in a motor vehicle accident 10 days before this. So she comes in, bright red, short, spiky hair. She's probably in her late 50s, but she's dressed like a hippie, tattoos all over, earrings down to here. I went to raise her necklace to listen to her heart and to examine her, and it just got stuck in these earrings and then in her hair. I mean, she was like in bright colors. I had to say to the orthopedist, who I called later, she's colorful, but she's lovely. That's what I told her. I actually said she's colorful and she's lovely. I wanted to give them a heads up. But anyway, she comes in. She had gone to the ER, been in the ER twice now, complaining of pain. She was what we call T-boned in a motor vehicle accident 10 days earlier by an undercover cop who ran a stop sign. And, or so she says. And she went to the ER complaining of pain in her. They x-rayed her shoulder, couldn't find anything. She went back, pain's getting worse. They x-rayed her lung, couldn't find anything, examined her. She waited and waited. Now she comes back, she sees me 10 days later. And I look at her and I thought to myself, I walk in the room, I said, this woman is a fractured clavicle. I didn't know her story at all. But I examine her. Sure enough, she's exquisitely tender, this part of her clavicle, near her shoulder, but swollen. And I said to her, you know, honey, I think you've broken your collarbone, and I think that's why. First, I said to her, look, people are in motor vehicle accidents. You don't heal from these musculoskeletal injuries. They can take weeks. Because she said, when am I going to get better? I'm no better. I can't do anything. She happens to be left-handed, poor baby. But she just, you know, like, I can't get dressed. I can't comb my hair. I can't do anything. Anyway, I sent her over for an x-ray, and sure enough, she has this fractured clavicle. So, and it's displaced, you know, it's not in line. So I called the orthopedist, and the orthopedist starts right away. Well, was everybody asleep in the emergency room? And I said, I don't really know. I said, maybe it wasn't obvious. The orthopedist says, of course it was obvious. It took your eyes. You're the only one. I said, well, you know, I'm sure, I'm trying to, like, that you see how easy it is to go to, wow, I picked it up and they missed it twice. So easy. And it would be, you know, I could live in that all the time. It's subtle what goes on. It's subtle about the choices we make and that we need to keep making to be in places where we are, in fact, challenged more so that we can grow. That's not growth. That is just sucking me down that dark tunnel. That is why Master said, a room can be in darkness for thousands of years. The instant you turn on a light, the darkness disappears. I've said that a million times, literally, and in so many classes, because every single thing we need to know about our path and about stress is right there. And that is, you cannot deal with the stress. You cannot fight with the darkness. You have to take yourself towards the light. You have to. Or you just keep fighting battles. So eventually, and even if you have to fight some of those battles, because that's your karma, that's where you are, you still have to make sure that you set aside certain time that is sacred time. It is sacred because there's too many devils that no matter what comes up, and I've said this many times before, there is nothing in this world that would keep you from meditating 5 minutes twice a day unless somebody has a cardiac arrest in front of you. That is the only thing that shouldn't wait 5 minutes. The only thing. Otherwise, I can't think of a thing in anybody's life that I know where you couldn't take 5 minutes twice a day. We don't take it. That's different. But can't? No, not true. We don't want to. We're not ready. We're being lazy. And as long as we're being lazy, we suffer. Because the nature of delusion is for us to suffer. And we just will. We'll just keep suffering. And one way or another, We'll struggle with things, no matter how far down this path we are. We'll get into places where, you know, we're not pure joy. Why would we do anything but pure joy when we have that option, which we all do? But the choosing of it takes energy, consciousness, willingness. You know, Master said willpower is desire plus energy. This is his definition. Desire plus energy directed towards fulfillment. There's a lot in that too. You know, you look at all these sentences that he had. So it's not just desire. It's not just, gee, I wish I could do this. You have to bring the energy in. And then you have to direct it towards the light is what he needs, towards oneness, to move us into a state of yoga, of perfect union, and of that memory of who we are. But it's never going to get easy. It's simply not easy. But like Swamiji was saying about us never hearing anything new, the spiritual path really is simple. The truths are simple. There's not one thing new. I know this as I'm talking. Thinking to myself, gee, I hope they're not bored with it. I know they've heard this, you know? But it's not easy to do it. And why do we come here, all of us? We come here to get inspired to take our next step. Not that we didn't know where we should have been heading before or where we could have been. Not should have been, but could have been. We knew. Everybody here knew. I know you and myself. We just need to be reminded all the time. So,
can I say something?
Please.
You were talking about finding the time for meditation. It's like every day I do my energization exercises, and sometimes ours is, oh, we don't have time, you know, or I always make time because I find that when he say we don't have time, if you just do it, you have the time.
Right.
And, you know, that person, he goes, oh, but the workman's showing up. Oh, they're always late. No, but I always have time to do my energization.
Good for him.
Yeah, but I'm just saying.
You're saying it is a reminder, and it's a very, very important reminder. When I went through medical training, and I was working 120 hours a week, I did not quit. Mostly I would sit and fall asleep. But I sat with that right intention. I did twice a day. People used to say to me, how do you have time to do that? And I would say to them, how do you have time not to? Because of just what you're saying. If you don't do it, you're more tired. Time goes by more quickly. You don't make the same use of your time. Believe me, I was not really meditating. I was sleeping. Some spiritual teacher told me I was guru bathing. Like sunbathing, you know, guru bathing, because I just sit and fall asleep. But I was sitting with right intention, right mindedness, right attitude. If I stayed awake for seconds, that's what I was going to do. I was exhausted physically, but I was not going to let go of God. I just was not going to let go of God. And that's what I carried with me. And I think you're absolutely right. And you know, I used to, you know, when you're in training, you have so many patients that you're carrying in the hospital, you have to have a clipboard. Everybody has a clipboard. It's sort of, you know who the residents are, the interns and the residents, because they have that. But I always kept a picture of Masters, some spiritual saying, right on the front of my clipboard, in the pockets of my lab coats, just because I had to be reminded all the time. It was a very good thing to do. And just having them run in front of your eyes as many minutes as you can. This is why I love in India. You know, I haven't been to India for about 6 or 7 years now, and it's changing so rapidly. But when I used to go a lot, which was 20 years ago, I used to go a lot, you just didn't walk into a store that there wasn't a Ganesh or a little altar set up. Or didn't matter what they were selling, what they were doing. They could be ready to rip you off for every rupee you had in your pocket. But there was Ganesh and there was an altar. And you know, it really meant something. It really did. And that's what they chose to put in front of them all the time. Anyway, let's take a little break. Okay, yeah, I want to get all of these questions. I'm going to repeat them since we don't have a microphone or any way, but yes, your question is.
How do you know what God wants you to do? Like, you're stuck in life, you're doing something, and you're doing what you're doing, but how do you know what God wanted you to do?
So, you know,
that is another thing, but
how do you even know for sure that it's coming from God? You know, it's interesting. Swamiji has spoken about this in many of his older talks, and he says, you know, because you're talking about how do we attune ourselves to that energy? How do we use our intuition that we're perceiving the truth, really, and knowing something intuitively, and not that our ego's telling us, gee, this would be a good thing to do, because it's very subtle, and I think it's the hardest. That's the hardest thing. That's right at the core of the path. Are we still being drawn by our egos in a more and more subtle way, which we are? Would we recognize it? Or is it really coming from God? So what I say about that, and, you know, I can only speak to this because of those moments when I've known for sure God was talking to me. So maybe everybody's had them in life. I've had them a few times. I can't say that I live there, but where I can really say God came to me and I know it. And it's such a kind of crystal clarity that when it really happens and it's just there and you say, that's it, and your mind quits doing all of what it does, which is usually this kind of a discussion, like, oh, I know this is the right thing. I'm sure of it. Yep, I'm certain. Well, wait, but what if? No, 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 that's not going to happen. No. And usually you go back and forth like that a lot. And when that, all of that noise falls away in certain moments, and you just almost act without, you realize that you have not thought about it. I don't know how else to say it except it's clear. I think a couple of you have heard me say, I used to live with this. This is a silly analogy, but when I was in medical school, I was always terrified that somebody would have a big liver and I wouldn't feel it. And everybody kept saying, don't worry, you'll feel it when it's big, you'll feel it. You know, most of the time you cannot feel a liver because it's protected up under the ribs. By divine plan, it's that way. And the first time I ever felt a liver, and you go, oh, that's what it is, then you know you'll never miss it again. And I feel like it's that. You know?
That's a good analogy.
I said it's a weird analogy, but it's hard to put it into physical terms, that when you have it, you know it. So that's one thing I'll say. But the other thing I'll say is this. Most of the time, we're not sure. Most of the time, let me just stop for 1 minute. So most of the time, we're not sure. Thank you. I was just going to ask. And we're left with what you're saying. How do we know? Because we know it's subtle, and we don't get that kind of absolutely, that was divinely inspired. And what Swamiji says about that is, it is always better to act on something than to just stand still, because there is no standing still on the spiritual path. If you think you're standing still, you're actually going backwards. You're being pulled down. So he says, take a few steps towards what you think you're being asked to do, and you'll know. If it's not, you'll get closer and closer. You'll have a feeling, wait a minute, I thought this was it, but this isn't it, or at least not for right now. Or you take a little step towards it, and you ask yourself, you plug in again, how's it feeling? And then you can say, yeah, this is feeling right still. He said, so you don't go running full force into things if you're not sure, but you make sure that you keep moving in the direction that feels most right to you, and then you stop and you check in. And you check in by literally sitting in front of an altar and asking God. You just literally do that. It's something that's so hard to remember. I was with a patient late last night, a private patient, and he was telling me about everything that's going on for him. It's a lot right now. Issues with his wife, issues with his son who just went into chemical dependency treatment in Southern California, this, that. He's got this big test to take for his business to get another license. And he just went on. He was so pressured. He was doing this to try and explain why he forgot about an appointment with me last week. So at the end, I said to him, well, I'm still going to charge you for the appointment, you know, which was not what he wanted to hear, because there's a lesson there for him. And then I said to him, have you prayed about this? And this man's been in recovery for quite a while, and he knows about praying through the 12-step program. And he just said, oh, my God, I've never thought to pray. And as soon as we sat and we prayed together for about 10 minutes, and he just said to me, I haven't felt this good in over a month. Well, of course he hasn't. You know, so you have to remember to pray, which sounds silly, but it doesn't always come to us. But you sit in front of your altar and you say to God, I need your help right now. You just talk to him like you're talking here or now or to us or to a friend. I'm confused. Show me which way to go. Here are my choices. Here's what I'm feeling. Give me some inner direction. Let me feel that. Let me see that. And it's amazing how often it happens. Sometimes when I really want to feel that Master's with me, and I know Master's always with me, but I forget, so I need that reassurance, I'll tell him, I'm going to close my eyes, and if you can just let me see your eyes, it would mean so much to me. Just, I know I need this, and I know it's silly, but just let me see your eyes. And it's amazing. I mean, it brings tears to my eyes how often he shows up like that. He'll just let me see his eyes and his face for a moment, and I just, my whole being smiles, and then I move on, you know, probably tripping around the world, doing a million wrong things, but Master's with me. So I think we have to remember to keep checking in. That is, and it's not comfortable at first, it's not obvious, you don't feel like you're getting any answers. Believe me, I know all that, because we all live there a lot of the time. And it gets less and less the more you're practiced. You can really find God within yourself more and more easily as you do that, but you have to start practicing doing that. And then when it happens, you know. But at least for now, you can know that you're always checking back in. And that really makes a big difference. And you don't have to make a big deal about it. You don't have to sit to meditate for 45 minutes to do it. Anytime during the day, you just stop. I want to feel your presence. I have a question. I have an issue. What should I do? So it's, you know, the hardest thing about all of these teachings is that they don't appeal to the logical mind. That is just the hardest thing. And the mind keeps wanting a logical answer. And an answer that the mind will say, oh, that's how I do it. But it's never going to happen. It's not going to happen. But when you feel that in your heart, when it happens, it starts happening, you know it's so much more real than anything your mind ever has told you or led you to believe. And if you just have to take that on a little bit of faith right now to move forward, then take it on faith, because nothing can hurt you in the meantime. It's not like somebody saying, lay your life on this fact, or put $1 million on the fact that you're going to find God, or take some chemotherapy, or it's not like that. It's saying, do something that can only possibly help you, that couldn't hurt you, because the more you do it, you know, Master says, I never want anybody to take my word. Just believe me because I say it. He says, take it into your laboratory. But our laboratory for each of us is inside. So this whole thing that we talk about all the time that's so obvious and simple about needing to go inside, not out, that all of the answers that we need are inside. I listened last night to a couple of Swamiji's talks. There were no talks on, what's the title of this talk?
Stress.
There was no talks on stress. But he talked about overcoming emotions and overcoming fear at some point. And I was just listening to them just for inspiration. But for all those hours that I listened, really what he was saying is, You have to go in, not out. You have to realize he tells over and over and over what happens with each birth, the nature of duality versus unity, how, of course, we're all living with duality and what it means to become one again. He just says the same thing over and over because it's the essence of the truth. What else can you say? You can't make up more truth. This, and I think to myself all the time, we say every week, truth is one and eternal. Realize oneness with it in your infinite, in your deathless self within. Thank you. Yeah. Truth is one and eternal. Realize oneness with it in your deathless self within. It's just, it's such a simple line. We say it every week. How often do we really hear it? There's only one truth. And as Swami says, if the entire world as we know it were to disappear and have to start all over, which we know it's done many times with many, you know, different cataclysms, things that have happened, we know that. We have proof of it now. I mean, geological, scientific proof. Somebody's going to rediscover the truth again because it's the truth. It'll just present itself. And the simple truth at all of this is that we, our lives are dualistic. And we are constantly being pulled out, and we need to keep turning ourselves around and come in. And that's where the truth is, and that's where we find that God, when we know for sure when God is speaking to us. Sometimes it means, when I was saying before, it takes energy, and this is the story, I'm not going to tell this whole story because I've told it many times, but I got really, really confused and lost in the year 2000 about my relationship with God. I mean, really lost. And I sat down and said to God, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to pray, but I am not moving. I will not have a drink of water. I will not get a bite of food to eat. I will die in this spot if I need to until you speak to me. And no riddles. I don't want a riddle. You always talk in riddles. Too complicated. Tell it to me so I understand it immediately. And I would check in. This is really a true story. Sitting on a tatami mat in my friend's house. She was away. I was doing a long seclusion there. 3 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours saying to God, I mean it. I mean it. I'm not moving. You know, and just pray and pray. It's all I did. 12 hours. He came to me. That's a long time. It was a long time. I wasn't even sure I believed in him anymore. I was so mad. But I just wouldn't budge. And I mean, you know, it's sometimes I feel very sad that I'm still telling that story because I haven't done that like that in all these years. That was 2000. And I brought all that energy to, I've meditated for long hours and I've prayed hard, but just laying my life right on the line. Talk to me. And that's what God wants. I mean, it's not like God's separate. That's the magnetism that we need to put out. That's the energy that we need to put out all the time. And then we get the response. But it doesn't come with just in passing. It doesn't. Gee, I wish I could meditate more. Gee, I'd like to. Okay, if I have time tomorrow. Oh, I didn't do it again today, but I'll be here tomorrow. It doesn't. You know, it's like what teacher was it who said, you know, if you're a parent and you have a little child and the child just whimpers every once in a while from its crib, a little whimper and then it's quiet, and a little whimper in an hour and it's quiet, you don't go pick it up. You know, you want the child to sleep, you're the parent, you let the child be. When that child starts screaming, you go and you get it. Of course you do. And you pick it up and you comfort it and you find what it needs. And God's the same way with us. So we need to say, I really mean this. I'm serious, and I'm going to show you that. And then it happens. And it's all these notes that I wrote down to myself, and it's really all of what they say. Do it with energy, do it with willpower. You know, don't think of it as, don't be apathetic. Don't think of it as being wrong or a mistake that a challenge is in your life. Really ask the question, why is this happening? Why is this happening to me? Not, why is this happening to me, and turn your back on it like it's some mistake. There are no mistakes. There can't be mistakes. Karmically, energetically, we have literally drawn every single moment to ourselves. Every moment. There's nothing that's happening that's not exactly perfectly for us. And we can either just complain about it or sit and watch it or do nothing, or we can say with great seriousness and from a place of deep devotion, why is this in my life right now? Why am I being faced with this? And not just bad stuff, some of the good stuff too. Because otherwise we just tend to enjoy it at a very human level. Gee, this is lovely. I'll just enjoy it. But wow, look at this gift I'm being given. Why is this gift here too? This isn't just about the troubles. This is about practicing the presence of God. Practicing the presence of God. Working towards that realization that everything that's happening, every bit of what we're having in our lives is real and very specifically, completely and totally, only for us. That's why we should never judge anybody else. We have no idea what their karma is. None. Zero. We can't. It's impossible. And their karma is going to drive them to do. We can offer advice. We can try and tune in ourselves to where somebody else is and say, this is what this looks like for me, or try this. If we're coming from a place not of our own likes and dislikes, because it's all of our own likes and dislikes that keeps us bonded to delusion, to ego. We have to rise above them, expand beyond them. We have to turn all emotion into deep devotion, because as soon as we're emotional about anything, we have a stake in it. And once we have a stake in it, our energy's influencing it extraordinarily, and we cannot hear God. It is impossible. You know, many of you have been at now a couple of talks. This will be the third time that I shared about an experience that one of our newer members was just sharing with me. But it was so beautiful. And each time I share it, I get about 10 emails from people saying, really touched me. So I'm willing to keep repeating it. But I was talking to a man a few weeks ago who came to our church. He came here for a meeting. He was not looking for anything. He didn't think this was his church. I mean, it just was nowhere in his consciousness. And he said to me, I walked in. And then, I mean, he was crying when he was telling me this. And he said, and then they whispered to me. And it's just so poignant. And those of you who have been around last Sunday or at Master's Mahasamadhi know we've been, this song, one of Swamiji's songs, The Master's Love for Me, it's a very beautiful song, and I'll tell you all another story that nobody in the room knows, but it's of course a song that we would play for Master's Mahasamadhi, and it's very beautiful. And one of the verses is, how sweet the sound of Om, its master's voice I hear. In all pervading silence, he whispers, I am near. And it's put to beautiful music. And it's just so beautiful. But I just had this experience with this man where he told me in such a touching way, it was so personal when he said it to me. Now, of course, people all over the world have been listening to it, and I keep praying it's okay with him. But because it was just so his experience with God, but just the way he said it, like it was real. They whispered to me, well, if we're making too much noise, you know, we don't get to hear it. We just don't. There's two stories I want to tell you. One is Bharat has a story written in his book, Om, I think. So probably a couple of you have read it. But about during the Great Depression or World War II, one or the other, it doesn't matter. People were sitting in an office. They were looking for somebody to, what do they call it, telegrapher? Somebody who sends Morse code. I can't think of what they're called. Everybody was talking, and the room was packed with people because nobody had a job. Everybody was looking for a job. And finally, one man very quietly stood up, walked into the office, and then the man who was conducting the interviews walked out and said, "Thank you, we found our candidate. You can all go home." And they said, "Well, you didn't even call anybody." And they said, "Yeah, we tapped out on Morse code. If anybody's listening, come in." And the only person who was quiet and listening walked in and got the job. And it's a beautiful story because it really speaks to the fact that we have to spend time listening, that these masters whisper to us very often. And we have to ask for what we need and then be quiet. Prayer is when we talk to God. Meditation is when we listen for the answer. So after the night of Masters Mahasamadhi, which I found to be just I don't really have words for it, but it was a deeply moving night. I mean, I think most people who were here felt that. Master was present. He was present in everyone and everything. The altar was gorgeous. The music was beautiful. Everybody who read, they read like they were Swami or Master. It was the orchestration of it. They're going up, they're coming down. Had to happen 7 times. It was perfect. It was just perfect. We even found the most beautiful little bell to ring at the end of each meditation. I mean, the whole night was just exquisite. And the next morning was our staff meditation. We meditate together, not this staff, but all of the staff from East West, staff from the community, staff from here. We all get together Tuesday mornings. We meditate for an hour, and then we meet. And I was up really early, but I did not want to go. I didn't want to talk to people. And I knew not only would I talk to people, but I sort of would be bringing the energy together. And boy, I didn't want to leave my house in that silence that was still there with me from the night before. But I needed to, and I knew that it was right to go. And as I'm walking out of my house, I said, "Who's ever leading this morning?" Because I hadn't looked, I don't know who was leading our meditation, a different person doesn't. Could they possibly think to have the chant be "Master's Love for Me," which we have never, ever once played. It's almost never done as a chant. It's a song that the choir sings. And it's never been, I've never heard anybody use it as a chant at that. And I said, could they just know that? Like, that would really soothe my soul. And Tandava was leading that morning. And that's the chant he led. And when I brought it up later in the meeting to just talk about Master's presence, because that's what that felt like to me, even that next morning, Tandava said, that was not the chant I was going to lead. I didn't want to lead that chant. It would not leave my mind on the way over here. And finally I said to myself, as I sat in front of the harmonium, can you hear this? You are supposed to do this chant. I mean, just such beauty when we listen. These are real stories. You know, other people call these things miracles. Asha wrote a whole book of people's miracles. You know, I sent her so many miracles for that book, and however many are in there that happened in my life, 4 or 5, because it's just what happens. You know, I just want to say to everybody, look at me. I'm just like everybody else out there. It's not like I'm such a great meditator. I just am who I am, like all of us. But I pray believing. I know that these masters can do anything. I know they can come to me in any moment of stress and help me. It doesn't even mean they remove the stress, but they help me feel bigger than it. So the stress goes from that place of taking up my whole life in the moment, which many things do. People get obsessed about jobs, obsessed about marriage issues, obsessed. It takes up your whole life. But that same situation looks smaller and smaller and smaller the more you move into an expanded state of consciousness. And you don't even have to figure out how or why. Don't waste the time. Just do it. And suddenly you begin to realize life is different than it ever was before or ever will be. But you have to do it. You have to do it. You have to put in the energy. In order for energy to be transformed, it's got to be there. Jan, did you have a question or statement that you wanted to make?
Yes, you covered some of it, but what I wanted to cover today for me is the stress buttons, the triggers, and putting it into action and play to be conscious during that moment without sticking my foot in my mouth.
But, you know, that's what we're talking about a lot, and I think, you know, this is very interesting. I was just glancing at my notes, and I'm going to go into it. Some of what Swamiji was talking about, some of the points he made, and we'll make it our own, but when he was talking about moving beyond fear. But I think, and I can say this to you, I've said it out loud now twice, probably much to your chagrin, but you are practicing all of this. You are the person who remembers, not only do I have time for the energization, if I don't do these energizations, nothing else falls into place. They are so important. And meditating is so important, and serving is so important. Probably the three most important things, all of which you do. And, you know, I can only speak for myself, but I just want to say, I don't know where I just said this, but I've had, this is a funny thing about teaching a lot and giving a lot of sermons and talks, and they come in groups like this. You can't remember where you've said anything, but if it's being said again, it's worth listening again. And this is not just for you, but for all of us, I think. But when I was young, I talked a lot. And I talked a lot all through my, I've talked a lot all my life. I'm still talking a lot. But I talked a lot, it was more driven by stress or anxiety. And I used to pray all the time that I wouldn't talk so much. That was a big prayer. Please help me remember to be quiet. And I couldn't. It was like a gumball machine. You put a nickel in and the words come out. And often I'd be so embarrassed later, like, they didn't need to hear what I was saying then. You know, even if it's relevant, people do not always need to hear. I was totally out of control with it. And it was a huge thing to me. I was always conscious, but out of control. It was very painful. And obviously what I came to realize, and I'm not saying it's a karma that I'm over yet, but I did come to realize that I was meant to speak a lot, that I am a voice for these teachings, and it's serving a lot of people. So the point was not to speak a lot, but to be able to make conscious choices about when I would speak or not speak, and to always be speaking as much as I possibly could, dharmically, and to be a channel for these teachings in my talking. So it was a transformation. And I think it happens, and I'm sure you're living that version of it, but where you just find yourself becoming more and more of that. Believe me, there are many times where I'm writing apologies the next morning, but nowhere near like it used to be for me. You know, where I'll still write to somebody and say, wasn't necessary for me to say that, or I didn't say it well. I mean, it's clearly something I'm learning about and living through, but if it happens 1% of the time compared to always going home as a kid, and some of that was just self-doubt, that I just didn't like myself when I was young. I just felt I was so incredibly insecure and self-deprecating throughout my younger life. And so I didn't like anything I said, even if it was, nobody else thought it was bad. I was still apologizing for it. It was a big thing. But this practice of, when I open my mouth to speak, let me be something that will add something to the situation. And that there's many, many, many times in my life now where I have something to say, and it wouldn't be a bad idea. But I say to myself, does anybody in this room need to hear that? And very often the answer is no. You know, it's just either people aren't prepared to listen, or it's not going to add to what's already been said. And it's been very useful for me to ask that question. Does anybody else have any questions right now or comments? They're very useful, as you can hear. They just allow for all the right things to be said.
said made me think or realize that when I do have challenges and I think, oh, I have too much to do, that many times it's just a challenge for me to raise my energy.
Yes.
That I'm sort of maybe lazy or complacent. And so it's a challenge for me to work to raise my energy. That's
a very, very spiritually meaningful. Swami spoke a lot about that in one of these talks, Angelina, is that sometimes we're being called upon just to do that, to raise our energy, and we, again, that is such a personal thing, but that in the very raising of it, we find that we have so much more energy than we thought we had. You know, it's interesting, Sister Gyanamata, who I know you know about, but who was Master's really most highly evolved female disciple. And she was, from the time she came to Master, because she came as an older woman, she was in enormous pain. I don't know what her medical issues were, because they weren't defined in at that time in the same way, but I think she had diffuse arthritis. She could have had anything. She had a whole body pain all the time. And, you know, she was constantly giving up her bed and sleeping on a wooden plank in the laundry room or for guests. I mean, she just never talked about her pain. Never. And one day she heard Master had called and was asking the other sister who answered the phone, could you ask Sister Gyanamata if she can do something? And Sister Gyanamata heard this other nun saying, well, you know, Master, she's really not feeling well. She's just like, and she yelled out, just say yes. And when that nun came in, she said, whenever Master asks for anything from me, you say yes and make it snappy. That's what she said. Like, without hesitation, you say yes. But you know, and again, everybody needs to know their limits. And I feel very respectful of this because I used to judge people so much for this, for not being willing or able to do as much as I did. I've always had a lot of energy. I've always been an early morning person. I've always had enormous energy. I still do. You know, I have more energy than most people half my age. But that doesn't make me great. It just means it's how Master's using me. But boy, did I used to be judgmental about it. We'd need help with something, and people would say, oh, I can't, I work full time. You know, and I'd be practicing 60 hours of medicine a week. But I really learned a lot about that. I'm much, much more compassionate about it. So again, this isn't about judgment, but I think for many of us, we have even more energy than we know. Yes is a very good word. If you say it to yourself, or you say the words, I will, those are affirmations, and they draw your energy up, and you feel the difference. You know, it's amazing. I was just writing an email this morning that's going to go out because we're looking for people to volunteer to help us clean up after Easter, on the day of Easter. There's a lot of cooking that goes on. There's a whole service. We convert the temple into a big banquet room, and we need some, you know, we need other people. And in this, I decided to make it bullet points, and I used the word yes in capital letters about 3 or 4 times because I knew, and I used it playfully, but if people read that word yes, it draws them up and they're much more inclined to say yes than if we say, could you please, will you, very different energy. We need you, no. It's like, wow, and this is what I said, here's a great opportunity for you. You could say yes. And it's just, you know, we'll get the people. It's just different because it's the truth. It's not like I'm fooling anybody. I'm appealing to what I know to be the truth. And that is that it feels good to say yes, and it draws your energy up. So if you see where you think your limits are, and you just go a little beyond it and a little beyond it, there's a book out now that everybody's reading called The 10% Solution. I haven't read it. But it's like, if we can just get teams, it's written, I think, in the IT world or some other world than here, to do 10% more, then a little later, 10% more, before you know it, people are doing a lot more. but you don't give them the whole job all at once because it's overwhelming and it shuts our energy down. So there's that, and then, and I know nothing about your life personally, but there is the issue of what are the choices we're making behind it? What are we saying yes to that maybe is no longer serving us, or that maybe we have to say, I'm going to take that energy and use it here. What do we actually really need to do that we think we need to do versus what else we could be doing with that energy that would be more elevating? And again, each person has to figure that out. But it's amazing how often in my work and in this church I hear somebody say, oh, somebody said to me just yesterday, a patient I was seeing, her mother has had a massive stroke and is total care. And her mother can't speak. And I said to her, why don't you get somebody, and she has her mother, she has her husband sleeping upstairs and her mother sleeping in the bed with her so that she can be there the minute her mother needs to get up. And I said, why don't you get somebody, hire, these people have a lot of money, why don't you hire somebody to stay with your mom? I was confused. Oh, she would hate that, she'd have a hissy fit. Okay, then of course you're exhausted, which is what she was telling me. I'm exhausted, I'm overwhelmed. Who wouldn't be overwhelmed getting up, sleeping in the bed with your 80-year-old mother, 80-some-year-old mother, and getting up every time she needs to get up to go to the bathroom, or and she grunts because she can't speak? Are you sure you have to say yes to that? You know, but maybe she has to say yes to it. Who knows what karma she's working out, but I thought I would just hold it up for her and think, maybe you can consider this. But we feel compelled sometimes, but we're not being compelled by our highest self. We're being compelled by something else. So there's all of that in there. You know, and then people you know and love get to say to you, would you like to talk to a psychiatrist about this before you make this decision? No, I really don't want to speak to a psychiatrist. No, it's really a good decision. But it's, you know, we have to figure it out. And then go ahead with it based on what we know to be true from the inside out, and not be living in terms of anyone else's expectations, anyone. Because the people that we find in life, and this is simply the truth, who have the ability to step outside of themselves and be there completely for you, and what is in your own best interest, your highest good, they are few and far between in this life. And I hate to say that, because many people are well-intentioned, but remember what Master said about that. And I'll just remind everybody in the room, because it's the truth, how many conversations we have in life where we say to somebody, a friend, a partner, a child, a sibling, boy, I really have just had a hard week. And they say to us, oh, you had a hard week. Boy, my week. And then you're often talking about them. Or I'm exhausted. Oh, I know just what you mean. That happens 98% of the time. I often hate to draw this to people's attention, because you start listening for it, it makes you crazy. I learned years ago, I just say to people, tell me about your week, because they're going to tell me anyway. It has nothing to do with what my week was like. The number of people who look at me and say, what happened? Just what happened? Why? How? Let me, obviously you'd like to talk about it if you mentioned that. Rare. And they're not bad people. These are people who care a lot about me, but they just, you know, it's very, very hard. It's hard for all of us to get outside of ourselves. I'm not saying this. This is a psychological truth, but I don't want to hold it there. I want to say it's one thing that it goes on every day in life. When we're talking about looking to people who can help us grow spiritually, we better make really conscious and clear choices and ask ourselves, is this person somebody who I can trust? And then ask yourself, is what they're saying to me, does it feel right? If it opens your heart, if it has you feel, even if it's hard to hear, like you feel it to be the truth, you know it, it draws you, pay attention. If it doesn't, don't take it on just because of somebody's title or position, because every person that we speak to is still in their body for a reason, and it can get a little confusing. I choose my teachers very, very carefully. I think long and hard. I meditate on it. I listen a long time before I go for other people's opinions. But we have to be careful, and so we have to do that, and then have the courage to act based on who we are and what we need. And we do that lovingly. We don't do that with total disregard for people around us, no matter who we're going to hurt or when we're going to hurt them. No. Sometimes when we can say, this might take a little time, or I need some room, or this is not the moment, but I'm seeing the truth. You know, there's so many situations you can't speak to them all, but that's the principle. But moving in terms of what we know to be true and not what other people know to be true is one of the ways of consciously coping with stress, moving through challenges, moving beyond fear. And it's not easy because we all want everybody to like us. And we want everybody to like us, but sometimes we get it turned around in our heads and we say, I don't want to hurt them, I don't want to hurt them. But really, it's the conflict or our own need for everything to be okay that we're reckoning with at the time. We still have to honor that, but we can become more and more aware of what's driving us. I always ask myself, as often as I can, I say to myself, just because it gives me pause, what is dharmic here? What is for everyone's highest good? And then you won't be disregarding anybody else, but you don't disregard yourself either. What is the dharma? It's a very important question. I always wish there was a better explanation for dharma in English, because it's really hard to speak about it. But I always say, that which when you do it, speak it, whatever it is, think it, will be what is right for everyone everywhere. That doesn't always mean it's going to feel good to everyone, because sometimes we just have to move in ways that upset other people. We just have to. So I could say to my friends, let him go, about their son who may well wind up dying. Let him go. Maybe this incarnation is over for him. Just think about that. You know, you have to be careful when you say those things to people, because if he went out and committed suicide, after that, they have to live with it. So you really have to get ready for that kind of thing. You have to know that you're okay. So I didn't say to them, this is what you need to do. But I did say to them, look how much you've given to him. Look how much you've helped his soul evolve, which they have. He was not knowing any love in that very abusive home till age 3 when you adopted him. Look at how far he's come. Just doesn't always look, it's not always what we think it is. So we spend a lot of time not wanting to hurt people. And that's not necessarily what's dharmic, you know?
There's such a parallel in the students in the class, in the example you just gave.
What does that mean? There's such a parallel.
Yeah, that, you know, there are all types of students.
Yes. Yes.
And making the wrong choices and then not motivated. So, you know, as a teacher, it's like we do so much, we can only take it so far.
Yeah. Well, the main thing is that you take it as far as you can. You can, and even the fact that you're noticing that they're all different and what their needs are. This is the great joy of this educational system that Swami Kriyananda wrote, Education for Life, and you know there's all these living wisdom schools, because even the teacher-student ratio, and I know there's a couple of teachers in this room and the people that I, you know, Caitlin's a teacher and I have enormous, enormous respect anytime I hear anything, and I know that any student that comes in her path is benefiting, though she's at a big public school. And I'm just sitting here saying to myself, wow, those kids have you and you're conscious. And you're doing the best you can to get more conscious and stay conscious. But we all know that's not always the truth. And we just do what we can moment by moment, and we don't keep regretting what we can't do, because that is really a waste of energy. But just keep looking to, and it's not just a waste of energy, it draws our energy back. You know, too much regret, too much sadness, too much looking at what might have been or could have been or would be. You know, it just doesn't help at all. You just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other and bringing as much as you have. And most likely, just by doing that, you even have more to bring. And each child that you're working with is just as different as we all are. Very complicated.
I have to say, with you saying that, is with every teacher that is on this path, I feel that those children they touch are so blessed to have the knowledge that you get from this path and to be interacting with the children.
I agree. Because what's in education for life really are the principles of this path, just with Swamiji's explanation of how can you share this with children, you know, but that each child is, it's extraordinary. They're learning, and what a perfect title, Education for Life, or Living Wisdom. I mean, it just says it all. You can understand it at every level, but what they're learning is how to be open spiritually, grow. And it's not, you know, most of the students are not Ananda families or Ananda kids. So it's the truth. They're just learning the truth, and they're learning it about themselves and being able to come out of that with so much self-confidence and so little arrogance. It's such a blessing.
I think, though, as a teacher, you know, not going through the guilt is very difficult, and I see that with the staff around, and that creates stress. Every single day.
Guilt about yourself or towards with the students?
Guilt towards the student that, you know, oh, I need to spend more time with this student.
Oh.
So that keeps pulling you back. And, you know, that creates the stress, I think, for many teachers.
Well, I think, you know, that's why you're here.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about. Not, you know, we can't fix all of them, but for us to know, you know, guilt, this is an odd thing to say, but guilt is such a, it is such an energy sink. There is not one positive thing about it. And it's, you know, but it's really hard not to go there at times, of course. I mean, it's impossible. Probably all of us have felt some of it, at least in moments. And if you haven't, God bless you. It's a really hard feeling, and it does no good. It doesn't do anything. It's just, how do we do that? That we look at what we just did, recognize that it was not the best thing to do, and really, literally say, okay, God, take this from me, and still learn from it. You know, so we're not just denial or, I have a couple of people in my life who just say, well, I did it, nothing I can do about it now. And that's not right. You know, it's not noticing it. It's allowing it in a way that we can learn and grow from it, not that we hold ourselves back with it. That is not easy also, but still something we need to pay attention to. Just want to see what, I've just looked down, this is the note that I wrote, I don't know why, this is for me, but one of the notes I wrote is, don't try and ignore the problem, don't kid yourself, be willing to admit mistakes, which in and of itself can give you huge relief, and then allows you to release it. You know, I had this very powerful experience last weekend. It was a very, very full weekend for me. I found out very late that I was going to be covering another one of Asha's classes and also giving Sunday service that she was supposed to give and also doing the Mahasamadhi. And this was all late Friday night or early Saturday. And Saturday afternoon I was officiating. It was never made clear what the exact role was, but one of my very best friends passed in November. And this was going to be her memorial service. And her daughter-in-law, who I just love dearly, and her son, and I really care about these people, but they have no belief in God, and they asked me to marry them years ago, and said the only rule is you can't mention God. I mean, it's very hard. And so I was stressed about this thing. It was just about 20-some people, but I knew a lot of them were not, they were just not on any path, and they would just say, I don't believe in God. And I didn't really know, was I just supposed to help conversation happen, or was I supposed to be a minister? It just had never been made clear, and now the moment was there. And, oh yeah, I had family service that I was doing on Saturday morning. Then I went right there, and when it was over, I just felt absolutely awful about it. I was driving away from there, I mean, and I just said to myself, what happened to me? What took hold of me? I said, look, I'm not certain how we want this to go, but I'll speak about Sadie first, and then we can all just speak. And that's what happened. Now, in my opening 10, 15 minutes, I spoke about her, who she was spiritually, how we used to read the Gita together, and, you know, right to the very end, how she would ask me to read to her, but always it was about books about saints. And but we didn't have a prayer. We had no moments of silence. And when I left, I just was sick about it. I mean, I really was. I felt like I had let everybody down. And I thought to myself, what am I going to do with this? I had to give service the next day, and I did not want to move into one of those almost perseverative places about it. And it's a memorial service. You can't go back and redo it. It was done. That was it. And I just... And I got home and I sat down in front of my altar and I said, Master, I really need some help. I need to move on from this. I cannot carry it with me. Help me. And the idea came to me that what I would do is that I would write the prayer that I would have wanted to offer for Sadie. And I would write it out because I knew it would be a very long prayer. That would be the form that a sermon would have taken if I were officiating for anybody here. You know, a talk. What talk would I give? It would be in the... So it would be a long prayer, and I would write it out, and then I would send it to everybody who was there and just say, you know, we never prayed for her. If this works for you, read it. And I was immediately free of it. I didn't take the time that night to write that prayer because I wanted to now meditate on and focus on the topic of the sermon. You know, it was already like 8 o'clock at night and there was a sermon to give the next day, but it didn't matter. Just immediately I could say to myself, okay, you didn't handle it the way you would have liked to have handled it. Whatever you let their wishes, whatever, get in your way, it wasn't a great thing to do. What are you going to do with it now? And it was such a perfect example of this, of just sometimes we just say, okay, didn't do that well. The idea could then come to me to write this prayer, which, by the way, was beautiful and long, and I could just let it go. It's amazing. But when we spend time trying to argue with people or defend ourselves, which creates a huge amount of stress in our lives, we just become more attached to that which is creating stress instead of just letting it go. Or even letting people tell us what they think we're doing wrong, which is really hard without getting defensive. But sitting and listening, and instead of saying, okay, I hear you, but, which you can hear a lot of times during the day from a lot of people, I've often learned to just say to people, let me take in what you're saying to me right now. Let me sit with it a little bit. Even if I don't feel it to be true, the fact that they're saying it to me has some relevance. So I've just learned, what is the point of getting into this, I said, you think, I think, I don't. And I would say 95% of the time I don't get caught. And it's so much less stressful because either they're right and I have something to learn, or I never can quite feel it, but who cares? It's okay if they think that about me, for whatever their reasons are. Really, most of the time, it gets harder and harder the more somebody means to you. So that's why we tend to work out a lot of this with our spouse or with our children. We really do. We fight more. You don't fight as much in the world, you know. Or a boss that you really want to like you, you get a lot more energy. But just ask yourself, how am I creating stress in my own life by caring so much about what everybody thinks? And this is not to say, what they think about me doesn't matter, because you have to ask yourself, is there any truth in that? What is the truth? Why am I hearing this right now? Why am I being told this? What can I learn from it? And take what you can learn and move on. You know, we're so centered in our egos, really. And our feelings get hurt so easily, and our pride gets injured so easily. So many times I'm asking myself, it's okay. What if somebody really doesn't like me? Really, and it happens. I mean, you can all feel I have a strong personality. I do, I know that. And sometimes for reasons I have no idea why, I can be so nice to somebody. Who knows, maybe we were arch enemies in a previous life. Maybe I was a Kaurava and they were a Pandava. I mean, who knows? You know, we just don't know those things. We carry that with us. So you just see somebody and instantly you just love them, or you get a feeling. And I've just said to myself more and more, everybody doesn't have to like you. Can you work with them spiritually? Can you still come together to work for that highest good? Can you serve God together? That's what would be dharmic. Get your ego out of the way. And boy, it's just so much less stress that way. You realize a huge amount of your stress goes away when you quit caring what everybody thinks in a compassionate way. I'm not saying in a dismissive way or arrogant way. Am I saying this well? This is an important point. Okay,
relating to work, because that's what's creating a lot of stress in my mind right now. You know, I don't get really any, you know, positive feedback from my boss, right? There's a lot of negative stuff that comes out. You know, I try to let it go. Okay, I'm not going to take this personally. Let me just kind of see what she's really saying and how I learn from that. But after a while, it really bogs me down, and it creates a lot of self-doubt.
Yes.
And it's very busy at work, but it's not the busyness that keeps, you know, that stressing me out.
It's that energy. Well, you know, here's what I want to say, but it's not an easy answer, but it's the only, there's two answers to this. One is you leave the job. That's the first possibility. I'm just saying, and this is where everybody, and I hear from a lot of people, oh, I can't leave, I can't. And often I say to people, really? And then as soon as we expand it, you could leave. But usually that's not the best answer, because usually we can learn something that's very meaningful to us by staying there. But not always. Sometimes we do just have to leave. Like, people are so negative and caustic. And then the spiritual lesson becomes, how do I find the courage and the conviction and the faith and belief to leave that which just seems like, oh my God, I need this. I can't afford to be without work. I, you know, whatever the things are that keep us bound there. Usually they're not all the truth. I'm going to say that, even though I can see from the look on your face, you're pretty sure yours are true. But, you know, just to say to you in a general way, we don't often have to hold on as much as we think we do. However, we can stay wherever we are. If we can, instead of just trying to tolerate something, let it slide off, or all of what you're saying, because, and I'm going to make this personal, I can tell when you talk about it that that's probably what you're trying to do. If you could get yourself to a place, now this is for all of us, where instead of simply doing that, which is not healing, which does not help, where we're just tolerating anything, if we can bring a lot of positive energy into the experience, if we can start walking into work with a smile on our face, saying good morning to everybody, saying anything we can either say out loud or to ourselves about how grateful we are to be there, how happy we are to be there, and really smile because it makes us feel good, not because we're trying to neutralize what she's or he's doing, as she, right, has nothing to do with her. It has to do with us and raising our own energy. It's got to be, get to be genuine, but for a while we can fake it till we make it. We can do that. We can just start saying, I'm going to smile. I'm going to be positive. I'm going to say an affirmation. I love walking in this door every morning. I love being here. Wow, this is perfect here. Not, gee, I wish I could, or what am I going to do to tolerate her? Not positive. Energy down. No. But you start doing affirmations. We have so many affirmations you could choose from. And you bring it there. And here's the best affirmation. And I swear to God this is true. I have, after I heard Anandi say this, up at Ananda Village probably 5 years ago, I would say 6 or 7 times when I've remembered, I've given people this assignment to do, and literally miracles happen. If it wasn't for confidentiality issues, I would give you names, and I would say, call this person. Because I have had, obviously, work is a very big stress place for a lot of people, and there's very few work situations. That's why it's so beautiful working in this church, to be honest. But there's very few situations where we go there and everybody's just positive with us, or there's not some negative energy. Very few. When I walk into Kaiser, every day, I just expand my aura as big as I can. And I can't tell you how many times people, it's conscious every day. People say, so great when you're here. Hey, Shanti, great to see you. Really, I'm out there like saying, we need to do this differently, that differently. I could be a big pain in their rear end. They're feeling the energy. But it protects me too. Very good thing to do. But this peace and harmony prayer, I don't think you've been around. So Ananda is on a path right now. Davy up at the village, who's one of the spiritual directors of Ananda, had an inspiration in meditation one morning. There's so many difficult things happening in the world right now. We all know it. We all see it every day. In meditation, it came to her that all over Ananda, all worldwide, as many people as we could engage, involve, we should be saying what is called the peace and harmony prayer. And the peace and harmony prayer is like this. The way we're doing it is 10 times, and we're doing it at every meditation, at every meeting, we're doing it at Sunday service. That's just Ananda Palo Alto. It's happening all over the world. I've been watching Jyotish and Devi travel all around the world. It's being said in Italian, it's being said in Hindi, it's being said all over India, in English, everywhere. And around the world, everybody is starting to say, Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony. Peace and harmony. Lord, fill this world with peace and harmony. Peace and harmony. Now, what Master said is if you do that, I can't remember his original instruction. We're doing it 10 times. So you would say, what is, you don't have to say, let's say your boss's first name was Shanti. So you would say, Lord, you would sit in your home, fill Shanti with peace and harmony. Peace and harmony. Lord, fill Shanti with peace and harmony. You do that 10 times, then you say 4 times, Lord, fill me with peace and harmony. Peace and harmony. Lord, fill me with peace and harmony. And you do it, now Master said 5 times a day. Honestly, it takes a minute and a half. You'll resist doing it 5 times a day, but it would be good for you to do it 5 times a day. And honest to God, Linda, without my even saying to people, when you go there, you bring positive energy there for your sake, not about her, because it will be so much better for you. You see, if you can bring the smiles, the positive energy into the office, without even saying that to people, which I think is very important, I think your whole office will change. Your whole office. But if you do this peace and harmony prayer, I've had people come back to me and say, it's a miracle. I don't know what happened. This is their words. I swear to you, it's true. I was about to be fired. A week later, that same woman's promoting me. Can I guarantee it? No. But can I guarantee it will help you? Absolutely. It will change you. And if nothing else happens, but if you decide to stay angry at her and say it's not fair and why doesn't she treat me better?
No, I just feel cruddy, and I, you know, again, I'm trying to tolerate it. And
I know, I hear it.
To develop a thicker skin and all of these
things. None of that's going to work.
Yeah.
It's not working. I don't have to tell you. It's not working. And you can hear, and anybody in this room can tell you, when you speak like that, how does everybody's energy go? When I do the peace and harmony prayer, where is your energy? So if you're talking about consciously coping, that's what it is. And even though the ego in you wants to fight, and I'm saying it to you honestly because I feel it, you want her to change. You want her to do what you believe is right, and this is terrible and awful. It's not going to change anything. You have to get out of your comfort zone and do something positive. And there is nothing else that works. And you know, if we talked about everybody in this room and situations we've worked in, you know, and I wish you were a nicer lady, but I don't know. What great karma for you if you helped change everything there. You know, really. I know this is, that's why I said to you 6 minutes ago, you're not going to like the answer. Because it really requires you to go somewhere you don't want to in your mind go right now. But that's the answer. And I wouldn't say this about everything I said today, but I'm going to say to you, it's the truth. It's not an opinion of mine. I mean, I offer a lot of opinions. That's different. This is the truth. Where what you're doing with it is not going to change it, and you will stay miserable. What I'm offering you, it will change it. And even when you can't really fully yet say, wow, that's great, I'm going to do it, start doing it. You know, there's a story that I tell, I've told many times, and I'm not going to tell it right now, but I had a patient years ago who had a really bad cancer and who came to me and just kept telling me how much she hated her husband for 2.5 hours I was with her. When she left, I wrote her a prescription that she had to go home and say 3 nice things a day to her husband. And she was enraged with me. She was feeling anger like I feel you feeling. And it was very clear with her, it was all at me. Yours isn't all at me, but it was like that. But she left my office and slammed the door. And the story is huge. But I, you know, she's like, what do you think I could possibly say to him? I said, well, I don't really know. You'll have to figure it out. But I said to her, you just told me that you're upset that he works so much. One nice thing would be whenever he's home, you put your arm around him, this woman who just told me in 2.5 hours, honest to God, 15 or 20 times, she said, I hate my husband, I hate him. I was just going to leave him, and now this, she said. She wasn't just going to leave him because she was in her early 60s. She hadn't left till then, but this was her next excuse to not do it. And she was just filled with rage, this woman. She was. So her husband was just one beneficiary of the rage, but there were many recipients, I should say, I guess. But anyway, the story's much longer than I'm telling you, but I wouldn't give her the other 2 things. And she's like, that's not going to be easy. I said, I didn't really say it would be easy. But why are you giving me this prescription? It was written on a prescription. I said, you know, I have a feeling it might help you. So she slammed the office door. This is true. The whole staff looked up at me. I said, she's a little angry. And then I said to them, I'm not sure she'll be back. She comes back 2 weeks later. We spend an hour talking about her medicine. Then I say to her, Mari, how's everything at home? She says to me, great, why are you asking? I said, are you kidding me? You sat here 2 weeks ago. All you could tell me is how much you hate your husband. I swear to you, this is an exact, I remember it like it happened yesterday. I've told it 20 times since then. But anyway, this was years ago though. And she said to me, oh, Dr. Rubenstone, you are not going to believe this. I said to her, yes, I will. She said, I was so angry with you when I left. Just like this, I said, I knew that. She said, I did not think I was coming back. I said, no, I didn't expect you to. She said, I was so mad at you. When I got in the car, I said to myself, you are going to do this just to prove her wrong. That's what she told me. She said within 3 days, everything at home had changed. I swear to you, these are her words. She said, my husband immediately took an indefinite leave of absence. He's been everywhere with me. He hasn't left my side. And I'm going to tell you, I helped that woman die. She died about 4 or 6 months later. I don't remember. I went into their home. I met all their kids. It was all house calls because she very quickly got really sick. I have rarely seen a couple come together so beautifully and go through that process. They saved themselves God knows how many lifetimes. It was so beautiful. This stuff works, you know? And if we want to hold on and be angry, it's okay.
I'm not angry. I just don't feel good going in there. I feel like...
I know, you can keep repeating that. Yeah, no, I know. That's your affirmation right now. It's very costly. I believe you, and I mean, maybe if I was sitting alone with you in my office, I'd take much more time to say, oh my God, that must feel terrible. You know, like all this stuff, the people, and I know, I'm not being facetious with you, and I'm really not being glib.
I don't mean that, this is why I'm in the class. How do I consciously cope?
Yeah. This class is going to be up on an MP3 in a few days. And you know, just skip to the end and listen again. And I honestly, I mean, we all have, believe me, I could tell some very personal stories. It's 1 o'clock and I'm not going to keep you all here with any more of my stories. But I tell these stories because they're telling of where I've been in these situations. And we just can't get out of them. We can't get through anything in life. And we, by doing what we're doing, but doing more of it, or doing it louder, and that's what we all try and do. That is the nature of the ego. We think in an argument at home, if I just say this one more time and I say it a little more clearly, surely they'll understand because it's the truth. Now, I just have to get more clear, or I need to do more of this. Like you're saying, I get a thicker skin, I do... But it's not the right way. You cannot solve a problem of soul consciousness, of super consciousness, with ego consciousness. You cannot. It is impossible. You can try as long and as hard as you want about any of them. You may as well stand there and beat your head against that wall. It will not work. And we'll all do it more. Believe me, me too, and I will try it. And I'll keep being sure that if I just say something or do something, or if I'm sweet enough, or there's endless manifestations of that. I mean, it's why Master says it takes 10 million lifetimes even to get to the human level. And then, how many lifetimes? Because these lessons are hard. They're very hard. The ego is real, and it has a real hold on us. It's not even bad, because it's the ego that lets us see, oh, now that's what I need to rise above, expand beyond. And of course it's going to want to hold on to me. Of course it is. Arjuna sat there with God himself and said, I will not do what you're asking of me. He threw his bow and arrow down on the ground. Arjuna threw a temper tantrum. How can we expect not to? And I mean that literally. That's what goes on there. Of course we'll do it. Of course we'll try. And Krishna basically said, I'm sorry. You can think how you want to think, but you're going to pick up the arrow. Now, he could say to Arjuna, if you don't fight, every person's life here depends on your being willing to fight. What he was really saying is, everybody ever knowing anything about the truth, you've got to pick up that bow and arrow. And yes, you have to go to war and kill these people that you love. Arjuna is saying to him, we have the same teacher. We learned how to shoot together. We nursed at the same breast. And you're asking me to kill them? Krishna says, yes, this is a righteous battle. It's hard. This stuff is hard. What do we know of that's great in life that we've ever been handed that we haven't worked for? What? You tell me. A law degree, a family, our children, a good marriage, a deep friendship, money. I mean, occasionally we're handed money. There's some good karma there, but really, what do we know? What else would we do? What else are we doing? We're only here to learn these exact lessons. Yes, it's hard, and absolutely go for it. Grit your teeth and do that peace and harmony prayer if you need to, but do the peace and harmony prayer and put her name in it. Everything's energy. Everything's being impacted. Every thought we have is affecting everybody in the world. Every drop in the ocean, if you remove one drop of water, the whole ocean has to shift around it. It's monumental to realize that. every thought we have, because we are all from the same energy. Master's example, or Swamiji's, of a pilot light is so perfect. You can look at a gas range and you can see 8 lights, but you follow them back, they all come from exactly the same place, the same source of energy. We are all connected. You and that woman who is treating you horribly, she is as much a manifestation of God as I am or as you are. And it's your job to find your way back there till you realize that. And just hold that. Everything in life will improve if we just make spiritual effort now. Sri Yukteswar said it. These masters don't lie. It's the spiritual effort that can get us, but hey, why not? It's not like it's beautiful sitting in the midst of, you know, these horrible things. No kidding, I spent the first 15 years of my marriage fighting with my husband, trying to show him all the things he was doing wrong. You know, many of them he would have admitted to. He did admit to. You're right about this, you're right about that, you're right about this. Didn't get us anywhere. One day I had the realization, every time I look at that man, I will see Divine Mother looking back out at me, because it's the truth. It's God herself. I will never have a critical thought again. Never. That came to me. Within days, our marriage was transformed. Days! I didn't even tell him about it, and he was dramatically different. What is that about? I held him in love. I held him as the perfect being that he is. That's not just about my husband and I. That's the generic spiritual truth for everyone and everything. And there's no way around it. There's no other way there. You want to go through a fire of purification? You got to walk through the fire. And we all have different fire. But, boy, it's such a... The reward is so enormous. The feedback so instantaneous. Even with one good thought. When you start feeling love, true love. When you know peace. When you actually can look at another being and know that you're looking at God, even if you're struggling down here, it's just, there's nothing like it in this world. Nothing. Okay, I've kept you too long. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Copyright 2016, Ananda Church of Self-Realization of Palo Alto.